There are a lot of different teachings in the world. And one that I see being expressed more often is that of the atheist and the agnostic. I'm sure that we all realize that there was a time when most of the world around here, most of the United States, were made up of believers. Increasingly, it's not. So, as you think about naturalists, sometimes called atheists or agnostics, they talk about the fact that this material physical cosmos is the sole reality. In other words, what you see is what you get. They say there are no spiritual realities such as God, angels, or immaterial human souls, and no supernatural realm such as heaven exists. After death, a person will never think again, never love again. Only oblivion waits and nothing more. You see this espoused by more and more of those who teach in universities. Amazingly enough, it doesn't happen as much in science and engineering backgrounds as it does in others. Many of these people are highly intelligent. They hold advanced degrees. But so many more are merely influenced by them. I want you to consider with me the predicament that they find themselves in. I will die. I will die soon. I will die alone. I will remain dead forever. I'm at the age at which, from time to time, it enters my mind, well, I wonder how long I've got now. And I'm certain that there are a number of you who do the same sort of thing. You think about, I have lived a good and full life. How much longer do I have to enjoy the things of this world? But you see, when you're an atheist or an agnostic, it's not a matter of if, it's only a matter of when. Another quote, human beings are the only animals who know that they must die, and thus the only animals who must try to hide for themselves the fact that they must die. Have you thought about how much time is spent in trying to reverse the aging process by the celebrities that are around the world? You know, you can go to Joe Biden and his hair implants that failed. But he's not the only one. There are those who get nips and tucks everywhere to try to lift up what has fallen down. They're trying to bring back youth. You know, to the atheist, death separates us from our loved ones. Death puts an end to our hopes and aims. Death ends in oblivion. The individual dies, humanity goes extinct, all life on earth goes extinct. Earth, its solar system, and the Milky Way, which contain it, come apart. And they ask themselves, why does any of that matter? I ask, why should anyone in any way try to delay, and that should be any of those events? As you start thinking about it, you say, well, mankind is raising the temperature of the earth. Does it matter? I happen to believe God will take care of that. There are a lot of mechanisms of compensation that are available to us. But have you ever thought about why an atheist should really care? After all, it's natural selection. And if we can't adapt to the pollution that we're creating, well, perhaps we ought to die off, is what they would say. But have you ever thought about why we form attachments to others? Human love. Caring. You know, one of the things that we have been able to watch on the farm in recent weeks is some good mothers and some bad mothers. We have some goats that lived and some goats that died. born, and you know, it's really sad when you see a small animal that's so cute die. But at the same time, you realize that if they do not form that bond to their mother, they will not remain close to her and so take her milk and survive. Why do we form these attachments if it's for some reason other than a mere accident of material recombination? Does it promote reproduction? Is that what we're here for? You know, as you think about that, you realize that physical reproduction can be accomplished just as easily by what the Huns and the Vikings used to practice, rape and pillage. We'll just go everywhere and we'll have children everywhere, and that'll be just as good as forming a loving bond in which to raise children. Have you ever asked yourself why an atheist would mourn the loss of anyone except himself? Why is it? What do you have to worry about? After all, they were a mere accident, a mere chance, nothing that you ought to get upset about. And so we ask ourselves, is there any reason for hope in all this rationality that we see them saying they have? And there doesn't appear to be any. We live, we have pain, we die, no one remembers. How is it that we care for others? As I was writing this lesson, I had to check Facebook for some other things, and a fellow that I went to school with many years ago, who's a movie star, was mourning the loss of his wife due to breast cancer 12 years ago. And as I got to thinking about this, she was an atheist. He says he is. Why was he worrying about her? After all, he believes that it's like a light that just goes out. Does he miss the years that he spent here without her? What was that bond for an atheist? What did she matter? Both he and she had no fear of God. I once replied to one of his remarks, "You don't know what God wants at all. You've never bothered to read his book." I knew him when he was a kid. He and his wife worshiped the material world and the material possessions that they had. He has not shared those with his fellows. He has kept them. They were worried about the world and the effects of all the things that they saw on the world. Why? She railed against pollution and greed. He rails against Trump. She's still dead, and all her activity didn't prolong her days by even moments. What difference does it make if we're here only as a singular, convenient accident of the movement of the universe? It was just one of those things that happens. But I will tell you that there's a fly in their ointment. Something to spoil the joy of opening that new cream. He hopes that there's time for another meeting. And she now hopes there won't be. She's in a place where she knows what's going to happen to him if he comes there. The rich man in Luke 16 wanted to warn his brothers. He worried about them coming to this place of torment. You know, as we read the book of Ecclesiastes, we see Solomon talking about what's it like to exist without God. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 16, he says, "There is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with a fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten. And how the wise man and the fool alike die." This man had a brother who was stricken with polio and rode around the town in which we grew up in a wheelchair all his life. This man, although he was rich, didn't buy a wheelchair. The fire department in town raised the money for that one. The wise man and the fool, the rich man and the poor, they die alike. And so Solomon says, I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after the wind. The King James Version there says, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Why do you go to work? Why do you spend your time in providing for yourself or for others if there is no reason for it to continue? As we think about Solomon going on in chapter 11, he's getting down to the point at which he wants to think about what is life like. He's thought about it without God. What difference does it make? However many years anyone may live, let them enjoy them all. This is a good piece of advice for every one of us. We don't know how long we have. But let them remember the days of darkness. Don't forget the bad things that happened to you. There are a lot of people who say, I just can't face that. Physicians have that problem when people come to them with cancer. People will be told that they have kidney disease and they're going to have to go on dialysis, and they just can't deal with that. In fact, it's such that now in many hospitals, physicians write down what they tell people as they tell them about their cancer. And then they tear out the page, the carbon copy, and hand it to the person. And the reason they do that is because they know that the person has not heard most of what they've said. The shock of you have cancer has taken away their ability to deal with anything. Remember the days of darkness. You who are young, be happy while you are young. And let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. You think you're not going to get bald or fat or old or wrinkly? Only if you die young, it's going to happen. Follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see, but know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. There's a time that's coming when we're going to have to sit and face our God. So then, banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the troubles of your body, for youth and vigor are meaningless. I know so many people who went to gyms, people who are near my age, and they don't go to gyms anymore. And yes, their shape has changed, and the wrinkles on their face have changed. And as you think about this, you realize it's going to face us all. Youth and vigor are meaningless. It's going to pass. Most of the great scholars of the world are well aware of the alternative theory. That is, there is a God who loves and cares for His creation. They just choose not to accept it. God loves and cares for His creation so much that He allowed His one and only Son to be crucified by sinful man, that He might redeem man from his sin and bring about the reconciliation of man with God, that they might live eternally. And the question that they ask is, well, what is the evidence? But relatively few of them ever bother to examine the evidence. Ancient words, as we're sometimes told that we find in the Scriptures. The tomb was empty. Have you ever thought about the idea that the tomb was empty? But I want you to notice who witnessed this. Two of the people who are involved in the burial of Jesus are members of the ruling council. Joseph of Arimathea seeks the body and buries it in his tomb. But when you start reading in John, you find out that Nicodemus, who was also a ruler of the Jews, brought the spices and myrrh and aloe so that the body might not smell. As you think about this, you realize that if there were any two people that anyone could have gone to and said, but wait a minute, you are a member of the council of the Jews. You are one of the leading men in all of Israel. Are you telling us that what these folks wrote about you is true? That you believe this? What a great way to disprove the theory. In Acts the 13th chapter, verse 27. For those who live in Jerusalem and their rulers, because they did not recognize him nor understand the utterance of the prophets, which are read every Sabbath, fulfilled them by condemning him. And though they found in him no guilt worthy of death, they asked Pilate to have him executed. And when they had carried out all that was written of him, they took him down from the tree and laid him in a tomb. But God raised him from the dead. And for many days he appeared to those who had come up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are now his witnesses to the people. He says, it's happening. You can ask these folks. It's not something that was done in a corner. Have you thought about that in Jerusalem where all this done, that 3,000 obeyed the gospel on the day of Pentecost after the resurrection of Jesus Christ? They were the ones who had crucified him. And 3,000 believed. And then a chapter later, we find that the number of men grew to be above 5,000. If you count the women, and it makes up anything like we have today, there were probably as many as 15,000 believers in a town of 250,000. They're approaching 10% of the total population. And you sit there and you think, they could have asked. God raised him from the dead. And for many days he appeared to those who'd come up with him. Do you wonder why the religion of Christianity spread so quickly? There were witnesses, not just a few, thousands upon thousands. And they believed. You know, the very first fiction that they talk about this, and I hope you can see these as well as I can. I'm sure you can't, but I also have them in my mind's eye, having been there. This is the garden tomb. It is a first century tomb. It's not the one in which Jesus was laid, but General Gordon of Ethiopian Sudan fame. You know, this is the tomb right here. See this little track right here? That's a curb. And this stone right over here, right there, that stone is rolled on this. You'll notice something about that stone. It doesn't roll easily. It's not like a marble. Notice the bumps. That thing weighs more than a ton. How would you like to roll that down this trench and see how rough the trench is? It's no better on the inside. It's not all nice and smooth. But as you start thinking about that, you say, well, how tall is that door? I started to put a picture in of some pilgrims, but that door is such that, yes, I have to stoop over, and yes, I have to lift my foot. On the inside, it goes back down. But as you think about that, you say, his disciples came and stole the body. Why didn't the Jews or the Romans? This could have all been stopped. You know, it started going and it started sweeping the whole of Judaism. As they start talking, why didn't they say, here's the body. Here's what they did. They bribed the soldiers. Say you were asleep. If you have any idea of what the Romans did to soldiers who slept, it was Pilate who said, you have a guard. Those were not Jewish soldiers. Those were Roman soldiers. You have a guard. Make it as secure as you can. So they sealed the tomb and put a block there. You know, as you look at that, and if you ever get a chance to go to Israel, go. I always had the idea that the tomb that they rolled in, the stone they rolled in front of the door was like a big marble. It's not. I specifically wanted you to be able to see this. There are a lot of pictures on the internet of this, but there are many fewer of this stone, which sets, well, it'd be right back here in this picture. Maybe down here about where my finger is right now. But I will tell you that it's most amazing as you sit there and look at it and say, he could not have rolled that stone. You know, there are no handles on the inside of that rock. He couldn't have taken that and said, I'm just going to roll this down like this. You sit there and say, I'm going to roll this down. Look at that rock. It's not round. It's not smooth. And it doesn't weigh 15 pounds. That's a big rock. You know,
John Dominic Croissant of the Jesus Seminar, said, well, I think the dogs carried it off. Wild dogs must have come and got his body and removed it. I want you to notice something about this thing. See this thing? They smoothed that off. See this? This is smoothed off. They did that so that not even big rats could get in. Very small things might get in, but dogs could not. They wanted those bones preserved.
And this was a new tomb in which no one had ever lain, built by a rich man. Of course, that's in fulfillment of one of the prophecies.
I want you to think about this. Jesus made 12 appearances following his resurrection. This is not something that these people took lightly. To Mary Magdalene, to Mary and the other women, to Peter. By the way, you'll be able to get copies of this if you want it. To the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. Then to the 10 apostles when Thomas was not there. To the 11 apostles. There's not 12 until after they get to Jesus' resurrection and ascension into heaven. And then there are 7 apostles in John 21. To the 11 again in Matthew chapter 28. Paul says to over 500 of the brethren at once in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 6. He appeared to James, the brother of the Lord, who did not believe until he was crucified and resurrected. What do you think changed? We'll read about it in a moment. To the 11 apostles. And finally, Paul said, as it were to one untimely born, to me also. Not only that, his resurrected body showed signs of the crucifixion. His nailed hands and feet and pierced side, we read about in John the 20th chapter. But they touched his body. They handled it. They could see him. They gave him a piece of fish to eat. Have you ever thought about that as they took it over there?
Do you think that they laid it nicely in his hands or on a trencher? Do you think that they didn't put their hand down to touch their Lord who had been crucified?
His body was flesh and bone. And it's recorded that it was touched. What we've handled, what we have seen, John says. What we have heard. I want to tell you, John is emphatic about this. Jesus ate and drank with his disciples. That should be drank, not rank.
John the 20th chapter, beginning in verse 24. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with him when Jesus came.
That's Didymus in the other. This version translates it. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see it in his hands the marks of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe. 8 days later, his disciples again were inside, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand. Can you imagine as he moved his garment and said, place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe. Doubting Thomas answered, my Lord and my God. He understood what he was seeing. You know, this is a really important story. From the standpoint of, you have a skeptic here. Someone who told those others, said, I don't care what you say, I'm not believing it. John knew this power. When he writes in John, the 20th chapter, verses 30 and 31, he says, Jesus did many other things in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. He said, I want you to have some evidence. John wrote it down so that you could know what he saw.
So that you could form your own convictions based upon what these men saw and understood. He knew how important Thomas was. That's why he recorded it in his gospel. It's almost as John were saying, I'd like to tell you about the skeptic, just so you'll know that we were not gullible people. That we all had our doubts until we saw.
Can you imagine how deeply ashamed Peter must have been of his sin every time he went to services somewhere and they
talked about what was written about Peter in the book of Acts. And after an interval of about an hour, another insisted, rather in Luke, saying, "This man was also with him, for he too is a Galilean." They could tell by their accent. But Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you're talking about." And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. Can you imagine what Peter felt like across the courtyard as the Lord looks at him and Peter has just denied with an oath that he knows who Jesus is? He was the one who said, "I'll never desert you." He remembers immediately, "Before the rooster crows today, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. Can you imagine how deeply ashamed he was? And yet you're going to find him 50 days later standing there saying, "You guys can crucify me if you want. I'm here to tell you about what happened." But you know, it's even more interesting than that is James. I realize the Catholic Church doesn't believe that Jesus had brothers, but all of the modern translations, except their own, indicate that he did have brothers. John chapter 7, verse 3. So his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples may also see the works you're doing. For no one works in secret if he wants to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers were believing in him. They were skeptics. The brothers of Jesus? "Yeah, we know who you are. You're the little kid ran around with us always claiming to be something great. You're not. We're your brothers. We know about you." In Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews, for lack of a better term, chapter 20, verse 9, the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, met his death after the death of the procurator Porcius Festus, but before Lucius Albinus had assumed office. That is dated to 62 A.D. And as you think about that, you realize here is a Jewish historian saying that this man Jesus had a brother who was well known in Jerusalem named James. That's what we call historical documentation. But I want you to think about this especially. The emergence of the Christian church needs an adequate explanation. How did this happen? According to the New Testament, the apostles turned the world upside down with the truth of the resurrection. How is it that this came to be? What's the explanation? We come together on the first day of the week, and we know why we do that. They came together on the first day of the week in Acts chapter 20 and verse 7. We know that the reason they came together was to partake of the Lord's Supper from 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 20. And we know that on 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 2, they were told to give of their means every first day of the week. They came together every first day of the week. It's one of those logical trains that you sit there and say, why did they choose Sunday? We read earlier this morning in class, unfortunately some of you weren't here, but we read about them coming together on as both Grecians and Hebraic Jews, is the way the NIV terms it, in Acts chapter 6 at verses 1 and 2. Hebraic and Grecian, and your King James will say the Grecian widows, as opposed to those who are Jewish widows, they were all Jews at the time. The Jews met on Saturday to worship. They went to the synagogue on Saturday. They did not travel on Saturday. How is it then that we find that they began meeting on the first day of the week? And you think about it for a minute. Apart from the resurrection, no reason existed for early Christians as a sect of Judaism to view Sunday, the first day of the week, as having in any
enduring theological or ceremonial significance. The resurrection of Jesus, therefore, set historic Christianity apart from the Judaism of its day.
They came together to worship the God of heaven on the first day of the week. And it changed everything, didn't it? You see, throughout the Western world, Sunday is a... Well, at one time it was a day of rest, a day devoted to the Lord. Now in the county where I live, it seems to be that I think that's the day that you honor the God of sports. You go out and you play all your lacrosse games and soccer games and all kinds of things on the Lord's Day, because there are a bunch of atheists who are running our counties and our schools. And you know that. And the only reason that they allow such to be done is because they don't think there's any significance to Sunday. But every time we come together in order to proclaim the Lord's death until He comes, as 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 26 tells us to do, we cannot help but remember, and this is the day of the week in which Jesus arose from the grave. He triumphed over the tomb. In fact, the first day of the week, from 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 26,
as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until He comes. And in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 10, John writes, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day.
It's not the day of the Lord. It's a separate thing. It's not the day when the Lord will return. It is the day belonging to the Lord. This day. And as you go about your business this day, think about how much of this day, which to everyone in what used to be known as the civilized world, that is, all those heathens out there didn't understand that we came together on the first day of the week in order to worship our God, to proclaim His death until He comes. This reference is to the day belonging to the Lord, the day of His resurrection. And every one of us remembers it. You get a little bit further along in the book of Ecclesiastes, and Solomon writes, now all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. Have you thought about your life? Have you thought about the resurrection? Do you look forward to that day when Jesus is going to come again and receive you to Himself? God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or bad. In Acts the 8th chapter, we find that Philip went down to talk to a very wise man of Africa. As they went along the road, they came to some water, and the eunuch said, look, water. What prevents me from being baptized? And Philip said, if you believe with all your heart, you may. And he answered and said, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And he ordered the chariot to stop. And they both went down into the water, Philip as well as the eunuch, and he baptized him. Think carefully about what this life is all about. Do you really believe that it's just going to be a click of the switch? And you don't have to worry about the things that you've done? Do you really think that God is not going to bring every deed into judgment, having seen this evidence? You know that it was written for you. It was done for you. And if you now believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, you may, just as Philip said, be baptized. If you would like to do so, won't you let us know while together we stand and we sing.